Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
From 90.7 WFAE, this is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. In 1842, at Faneuil Hall in Boston, a 24-year-old black man spoke about his life's journey. Here is part of what he told the audience. "I will not detain you long, for I stand here a slave at least in the eyes of the Constitution. It is a slave by the laws of the South who now addresses you. My back is scarred by the lash. That I could show you. I would I could make visible the wounds of this system upon my soul." The 24-year-old who delivered those words was Frederick Douglass, who went on to become one of the most important and influential public intellectuals in American history. Douglass is the subject of an epic and epically praised biography written by Yale historian David Blight. And David Blight, through the magic of technology, joins us today to discuss Frederick Douglass. Professor Blight, welcome to Charlotte Talks.
Thank you, Eric. It's great to be here.
So you've spent basically your entire career immersed in Frederick Douglass and various aspects of the Civil War. I want to start from the end and not the beginning, or rather how the beginning influenced the end. And what I mean by that is You were inspired to write this biography during a trip to Savannah in 2008, and that inspiration filled in a lot of blanks about the later years of Frederick Douglass's life. So what happened?
Well, I'm so glad you started there, because if Americans know Douglass, they tend to know that younger Douglass, the heroic escaped slave, who wrote about it in his first two autobiographies, but they do not tend to know the older Douglass, the Douglass of the post-Civil War era, the last 30 years of his life. That chance encounter you referred to make a long story short, is I went to Savannah, Georgia about 12 years ago to give a talk to high school and middle school teachers about Douglass's narrative, because they're teaching it. And while I'm there, my host at the Georgia Historical Society introduced me to a local gentleman named Walter Evans. And Walter is a collector extraordinaire. He is a retired African-American surgeon who grew up in segregated Savannah but went north for his higher education, did his medical school at the University of Michigan, and practiced for over 30 years in Detroit. But his passion for many years now, decades, has been collecting African-American manuscripts, rare books, and art. And in his house in Savannah, he has a simply put, an extraordinary collection of rare books and manuscripts, and he has an amazing Douglass collection, most of which is rooted in about 10 family scrapbooks that were kept by Douglass's sons over the last 30 to 35 years of their father's life. There are other family documents and photographs and manuscripts of speeches and so forth. But those scrapbooks and those family documents and the thousands of newspaper clippings contained in them that you cannot find in other places open up a window into that older Douglass's life, the patriarch of a huge extended family, 4 surviving adult children, 21 grandchildren, 2 or 3 fictive siblings who adopted him or he adopted them, his life increasingly as a political insider, as a government bureaucrat, but also as the constant itinerant traveling lecturer across the country and even abroad, always the voice somehow of emancipation, the voice about race, the voice of his people, the voice about the right to vote, the voice against lynching, and so on and so forth. It's that older Douglass that in some ways became the new thing or the period that almost took over this biography, because it's so rich and so interesting and in some ways so modern.
And one of the things that you write about in the later stages of his life, you alluded to it, he had 21 grandchildren, he had a very large extended family, and That was part of the reason that he continued to work so hard and travel delivering lectures as he had done through essentially his entire adult life.
He did. He had a public speaking career of over 50 years in the golden age of oratory, and he was one of the golden voices of 19th century oratory. But yes, he continued in the Reconstruction years, the Gilded Age years of the 1880s, and right on down to the last year of his life when he's 76 and 77 years old, to do these long, back-breaking, mind-numbing lecture tours of often 3,000 and 4,000 miles across the Midwest, out to the plains. And in the late 80s and early 90s, even into the Deep South, he did two or three lecture tours into the Deep South. And part of that was because because he had become so famous. The demands for him to speak were so constant, invitations so frequent. But also, as I say a lot of times in the book, he needed the money. He's got a big brood of people dependent upon him. And his three sons and one daughter, who had all these children, did not have successful professional or working lives in at least three of the four cases, for a whole complicated set of reasons, but they were dependent on Douglas, and we have a lot of letters that show that. So, yes, he was always the itinerant orator, even when he held these positions within the federal government, and he had three significant appointments in the federal government. Marshal of the District of Columbia, appointed in 1877, then Recorder of Deeds, appointed by Garfield in 1882. And then again, a third time, maybe the most distinguished of all, he was the U.S. Ambassador, or called the U.S. Minister to Haiti from 1889 to 1891. And one of the big themes of this book, there are about six big themes, but one of them is that I try to trace and weave throughout how the old radical outsider, the old radical abolitionist, always on the outside, beating on the doors, demanding that his country live up to its creeds, becomes after the war increasingly a political insider. And I don't say that as any kind of criticism or condemnation, but that does happen. And if we just think of our own relatively recent history, there were lots of leaders of the modern civil rights movement who had been radical outsiders, who then became congressmen, senators, mayors, etc. And there's the younger one who was a community organizer and even became president of the United States.
Yes,
so,
he did.
You know, Douglas is the prototype for that, that story. When you become an insider, what deals do you make? What possible compromises do you make? What kinds of rivalries and arguments will you find yourself facing when now you are trying to preserve the victory of your cause that happened in the middle of your life in a society where that cause is at first being eroded, and later, before he dies, all but destroyed?
Those are the words of Professor David Blight. He is our guest today. He is the author of Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom, which was published in October and has been on every top 10 list, I think, in creation, and was just this month awarded the Lincoln Prize. I wanted to ask you, congratulations on that.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask you mentioned Frederick Douglass lived 77 years. He was born in 1818, died in 1895, and that means he saw and endured not just slavery, obviously, but he saw the Civil War, he saw Reconstruction, and he saw the relapse into Jim Crow. Given that expansive view of American history, what would he make of our continuing struggle with race?
Well, good Lord, it is never easy to know, or in fact, it's impossible to know what he would think, but we can certainly surmise certain sentiments and attitudes. Back to your first notion of just the trajectory of this life and what he witnessed and commented on. He's born before steamboats are on American rivers. He's born before the telegraph, before the railroad, before the Rotary Press, which would revolutionize his own life as a newspaper editor, an abolitionist newspaper editor, that press that made possible daily and weekly newspapers. But he's going to live all the way to the age of electric light bulbs and even the phonograph, although, so far as we know, he was never recorded. But if you just think about it, he lives the story of America's evolution through slavery its self-definition through slavery, a nation so deeply complicitous with slavery that it ends up destroying itself over slavery. And then he lives through this all-out terrible war that ends up in the emancipation of 4 million slaves. And he is there to be part of. He even considered himself sort of a second founder, but he's part of this second American Republic, this creation of a new nation out of the Civil War, rooted in the 13th, the 14th, and the 15th Amendments, and in the Reconstruction Acts. But then he lives long enough to see that being betrayed, all but crushed, both by the courts, by Southern terror, by the revival of the Southern white supremacist Democratic Party, and so on. What he would think now? Well, Douglas would not be that surprised. You might want me to, I mean, some people might want a Douglas scholar to say, oh, Douglas would be shocked and appalled. He would be shocked and appalled at many things. He'd be shocked at the ignorance of this president. He'd be shocked at how a country could elect, in effect, a bigot. I'm sorry to be so direct, but let's be direct. On the other hand, one of the most noted aspects of Douglass's life and career to me was his sheer endurance of not only slavery, which he writes about so much, so deeply. He wrote 1,200 pages of autobiography, although not much of it about his personal life, most of it about his life as a slave and then his public life.
But which you really flesh out the personal life in this book.
Well, I surely tried. You have to as a biographer. Nobody lives their life only in private or only in public. Each of them are infusing each other every day of our lives. And if you're a very public, famous person, your biographer has to go both ways, so to speak. But he endured. He not only endured slavery, he endured the fear and hopelessness of the 1840s and 1850s. When abolitionists really, though they were extremely active and influential, had no right to believe they actually were going to see the end of slavery in their lives, but they did. And yet then he lives long enough, as we just said, to see so much of this fall apart. And he was Jim Crowed, that is, discriminated against because of his race in all kinds of ways, more times than he could even count. And early in his career, when he'd get thrown off a railroad car, he'd get denied a meal at a tavern or a restaurant and so on, he did react with outrage. With time, he began to even sometimes process these Jim Crow events with humor. Because after a while, how do you treat the absurdity of racism? But sometimes you just kind of throw it back in people's faces with a sense of humor. So it is his endurance of all of that that makes me suggest, though one can never know, that if Douglas were around, he would say, okay, caution, folks. We've been here before. Have a long view. Read. Have a sense of history. Know where we've come from. Know that there have been cycles in this, cycles of up and cycles of down. And though it is very, very hard to endure racism on a local, basic, individual level, and especially when you don't have any power to fight back with, you don't have any wealth to fight back with, and even when your vote is restricted to fight back with, it's very hard to endure. But his life is the model of an endurance of all of that in worse times than we have.
Speaking of reading, we're going to take a little break, and then we're going to come back and talk about some of the reading in Prophet of Freedom. We're speaking with David Blight, and he is the author of a new biography on Frederick Douglass. Stay with us here on Charlotte Talks.
Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins, and my guest today is David Blight. He is a professor of American history at Yale University, and he is the author of the new biography, Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom. And we were talking about the massive changes in American society that Frederick Douglass not only lived through, but also catapulted in some ways. And I want to go back to the early parts of your book, We all, I think, know the basics, as you mentioned, that Frederick Douglass was an escaped slave. He became this famous orator. He obviously befriended Abraham Lincoln after at first not being real happy with the president. But there's so much about this story that, is so rich and really hard to believe. So you start with a man who lived 20 years as a slave, born on the eastern shore of Maryland. But one of the things that you point out in his early life is how important the city of Baltimore wound up being to his development. If you don't mind, share a little bit of how he wound up going between the eastern shore of Maryland, which is very rural, and Baltimore, and why that was such an important stepping stone in his life.
A very important pivot in his life. Indeed, he is born out in a backwater of the American Slave Society on the eastern shore on a farm along the Tuckahoe River. He spent 20 years as a slave, about 11 of those years, out on the eastern shore, across the Chesapeake. Indeed, by the time he's a teenager, doing field hand work. He did all kinds of work as a slave, even on the eastern shore. But because of his owner, Thomas Auld, sending him first when he's only 7 years old, up to Baltimore to be the playmate of his brother's child, that is, Thomas Auld's brother, Hugh Auld, had a boy about Douglass's age, or Fred Bailey's age, that was his name then. He was sent there to be a companion slave. That, though, is where he first learns his letters, his alphabet, the capacity to read. He is taught for more than a year by his mistress, Sophia Auld, until she's ordered to stop by her husband. But the pony was out of the barn. This kid took to language, and you and I are sitting here talking about him almost entirely because of his words. Douglass became a wordsmith. He became a genius with language. Now, there are reasons for that. There is a historical process by which that happened. He didn't just walk out of slavery, this born genius who could get up to a lectern and, you know, knock your socks off. He had to learn all of this, and he learned it first through reading. And he especially read two things in his youth and his teenage years. One was the Bible. He read a great deal. Parts he understood, parts he probably didn't. But he also encountered a very special book called The Columbian Orator, which was a school reader he saw his white friends in the streets of Baltimore with. It was the second best-selling school reader in the country, next to the McGuffey Reader. It was a collection of oratory over time, both from classical antiquity and from the Enlightenment years. So a lot of the speeches and the language in there was all about liberty and reason and even, you know, anti-slavery and equality, believe it or not. But it also was a manual of oratory. The 20-page introduction was a how-to give a speech, how to gesture with your arms and your shoulders, how to modulate your voice, how to reach your audience with a moral message. The basics of oratory were all in that book. But more important, well, along with this discovery of literacy, which he seized on like any kid does when, you know, every kid wants to find out what they're good at, if they can. Whatever that might be, it might be hitting a baseball, it might be running, it might be, you know, language. And in his case, that's what, he didn't have many other options. He didn't get to join any baseball teams yet. But in Baltimore, this is crucial. In fact, without Baltimore, we wouldn't be here talking about him. He spends 9 of those slave years in Baltimore. He does go back and forth because of the whims and wishes of his owners. But in Baltimore, the year he escaped, in 1838, Baltimore had 130,000 people. It is a major port city. It's a major ocean maritime center. It's one of the largest shipbuilding centers in North America. That port was bustling with the world coming in and the world going out, and he worked down in the docks. But most importantly, though the city only had about 3,000 slaves, it had 17,000 free blacks. There was a huge free black community in Baltimore. And in that community, he gets very involved, because in a city, all of these things were possible. He may be owned as a slave down on on a street in Fells Point, but he's involved in four different churches in his teenage years, two of them largely white, two of them largely black. He names all the ministers to us. He gets involved with a local black preacher named Charles Lawson, who used to sit him down and have him read the Bible with him out loud for hours and hours and hours, because Lawson was not entirely literate, but he was a biblical, almost fanatic. And that's also where Douglas met Anna Murray, who would be his first wife. She was about 3 years older. He probably met her when he was about 18. She probably 21. But it's in that world that he begins to dream. He begins to read. He reads newspapers. And he begins to fashion this idea that of escape. And lo and behold, he finally does at age 20 at the beginning of September 1838. But Baltimore became kind of his imaginary window on the world, on its commerce, on its possibilities, on its modernity, on its energy. And he referred to all of that at one point as his Baltimore dreams. And he escapes at age 20.
You mentioned a couple of things in that answer. One is the way that he learned to use language. I'm going to mention one of many quotes that you include. By the way, his speeches, it's like a one-man Bartlett's quotations. But here's just one example.
It really is.
he says, quote, "The church and the slave prison stand together, and while you hear the chanting of psalms in one, you hear the clanking of chains in the other. Always the language is so rich, the images are so vivid, and as you say, part of that came from the Columbian orator and his study of it. And I wanted to ask you, because I know earlier in your career, you edited a 200th anniversary edition of that book. I can only imagine that that must have really helped you even understand Douglas more as you would later go on to write this biography.
Oh, absolutely, Eric. In fact, one of the thrills of my life as a scholar was when Cedar Hill, the Douglas House in Washington, D.C., run by the National Park Service, they've allowed me some after-hours tours there a couple of times with a curator in tow. But they actually allowed me to put on gloves and sit down with Douglas's own original copy of the Columbian Orator, which he carried out of slavery with him. The only thing Douglas carried on his body when he escaped from slavery by three ferry boat rides and three train rides was a little bit of cash in one pocket, a Columbian Orator in the other pocket, and dressed up as a sailor. He had nothing else, but he never moved anywhere in his life without that copy of the Columbian Orator. Now, his skill with language, you are so right. When you can read Douglas, and sometimes there are sentences and paragraphs that just blast you between the eyes, and you reread them and you think, oh my goodness, I couldn't think of that. How did he capture that metaphor? How did he capture that juxtaposition? He's always using these binaries, these juxtapositions, this and then that. Irony was his tool. It was his, like his precious ore that he could fashion argument from, and he was so good at it. Now, along the way in writing this book, and you can tell from the title, I kept testing myself. I kept trying to get up the courage to put the word prophet in the title of this book because so much of his language does read like the oracles of a prophet. And it took time for me to get that confidence, but I finally gained it by reading more and more theology, but particularly from a couple theologian friends of mine who told me what to read to zone in on definitions of what is a prophet. And I especially relied on the great Jewish theologian Abraham Heschel, who has many definitions of what a prophet is and was, and his template, of course, of the Hebrew prophets of the Old Testament. But those were Douglas's too. Douglas was deeply steeped in the language, the stories, and the metaphors of the Old Testament prophets, Isaiah, Ezekiel, Jeremiah, Amos in particular. And what Douglas can do is what Heschel says all prophets can do. And there are very few prophets. There shouldn't be too many of them. He says the prophet, this is Heschel, can speak in language one octave higher than most of the rest of us can hear or ever imagine being able to write. They hear a language in their head that allows them to explain terrible catastrophes, great triumphs, pivots in history, great dilemmas in history, fear, love, whatever it is in history that comes and hits us between the eyes. A prophet is that person who can find the words to help us, to help explain our condition. And the more and more you read Douglas, you realize, yeah, he's not always right, and he certainly doesn't predict everything right. And prophets, by the way, are not just people who are predictive. I mean, they don't just sit around saying, oh, this is going to happen, and then do the tally of how many times they got it right. That's not what a prophet is. A prophet is an explainer, as Heschel says, who sometimes will shatter us with the story, shatter us to wake us up. That's Douglas. He was an American Jeremiah. And he's that way early in his career, but especially as he grows and matures and hones this power with language, both oratorical and written. He was first an orator, second a writer. But once he became a writer through that first autobiography, The Narrative, in 1845, writing became as important to him as oratory. And one last thing about that. All of Douglas's greatest speeches, and there are dozens of them, are all in a textual form. He wrote them. They're not just spontaneous, you know, preaching. They're not just sermons off the top of his head to blow out the lights of a hall. He wrote them down. And that doesn't mean he didn't break from his text, which he did at times. But all the great ones are right there in his prose for us to read. And in particular, people may be today familiar with his 4th of July speech, because it is widely used and taught and even read.
1852.
Exactly. There's a letter where he says he spent 3 weeks on that speech, and it shows. It is a rhetorical masterpiece of the English language. It's a rhetorical masterpiece of the Jeremiad tradition, which is the altar call to a people, which is the warning to a people of the woe and the doom to come to them if they don't regain their faith, if they don't come back to their creeds, if they don't realize the error of their ways with slavery. That speech is like a symphony in three movements.
Those are the words of Professor David Blight. He teaches American history at Yale University, and he is the author of Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom, a wonderful biography that was published in October. Let me ask you a superficial question. As you go through this book, there's so many, just so many unbelievable things that happened to this man over the course of his life. And I'm sorry to repeat that, but when you go through a man who's in slavery, who goes to the upper reaches of power, who has these near misses from not only being reclaimed as a slave, but for being part of perhaps John Brown's attack on Harper's Ferry, and I'll let you talk about that in a minute. The thing I wondered as I got to the end is, why isn't this a movie? So is anyone talking to you about a movie about Frederick Douglass?
Oh, yes. There are a number of producers, directors, and screenwriters. I have several phone conversations. Well, a few I've already had, and I have a few more planned for this week and next. There's a lot of interest. There has been a lot of interest in a Douglass film for more than 20 years, and I've actually worked with a couple of producers on and off for over 20 years trying to imagine the ways in which Douglass's life could be put on film in a single feature and a TV series and so forth and so on. We've come close before, but that was always before this book was finished. Now, there is a lot of interest, but I've learned, and I'm not naming any names here, but I've learned to be very careful with the business of filmmaking. It can run hot and cold, even when a screenplay is produced, of course. As many people know, it doesn't mean the film will get made. It is a mercurial business, and I'm holding back this time. I'm eager to see Douglass's life come to film. To whatever extent I can have any control how that's done, and I won't have much, I want to work with someone who's very serious and feels the responsibility of representing this life and not simply about the act of entertainment. Now, a film is always entertainment. I've learned that. You know, a film is not a book.
Right.
I've learned that. And I am not a screenwriter. I've actually tried a little bit at that, and I've realized, nope, that's for other people. They have to capture way too much in just not so many words. But this is an epic life. There's no question. You can take any piece of it, which is probably what will happen. Although there is talk of a multi-part television series where you could develop the whole life, that's hard to say. There is already in the works, and I've signed on with this, a documentary film that is going to be made in four parts for HBO.
Oh, wow. Well, congratulations. And I wasn't crazy for having that thought.
No, you weren't crazy at all. And everybody kind of wants to know. And immediately the conversations always go to, who's going to play Douglas? And believe it or not, the author of the book has nothing to do with that.
Well, as we come upon a break here in a minute or so, I did want to ask you, tying any possible movie to back to the book, you and obviously contemporary accounts back this up. Mm-hmm. Write and talk so much about the sound of Frederick Douglass's voice, how sonorous it was. Mm-hmm. And since we don't have recordings, I'm wondering, who do you imagine? Do you imagine a Morgan Freeman or a James Earl Jones? Mm-hmm. Or is there a voice in the present day that you think would sound like Frederick Douglass?
Well, there are many of them. There are many great black actors, younger and older, who could do this without a question. There's one I will name who may not be a household name, but he is the reader of the audiobook for this book. His name is Prentice Oliyemi. He has an amazing sonorous voice. He's Nigerian by roots, and an experienced actor, probably some training in Britain and in the U.S. I don't really know much more than that. But if anyone out there has purchased the audiobook, he has a remarkable voice.
Let me cut you off for there. We're going to be back with more with Professor David Blight. Stay with us here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and my guest today is David Blight. He is a professor of American history at Yale University, and he is the author of the biography Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom. I'm sorry I cut you off there at the break. You were speaking about the gentleman who had done the audiobook version of your biography and how he really captures some of what you think Douglass might sound like.
Well, he's a marvelous reader, and I have suggested his name as a narrator for the documentary film that is now beginning in its beginning stages. Whether he would be interested or would be able to perform Douglass, I have no idea. There are many great actors, some of whom are right now reading the book and are keenly interested, so I'm told. But we'll see. I'm just concerned that if Douglass ever comes to the screen, that it be a truly serious, responsible, memorable treatment of Douglass. And I pray to God that it doesn't become a superhero movie. There are superhero tendencies in Hollywood now.
You're right.
And particularly for television series and even in regular films. And there's a certain heroism in Douglass's life that might lend itself to that. I'm not suggesting anybody in particular might do this or not do this. It's just there's a tendency in movie making to go in that genre, and I just hope that doesn't happen. And I'm not signing off on the book to anyone that I don't have some trust in. But once you sign the book away, as you know, it goes into the hands of the brilliant people who use this medium of film and can do magic with it as writers and then as filmmakers.
You mentioned earlier Frederick Douglass's first wife. Her name was Anna.
Right.
She was a free woman, followed him after he made his escape from Maryland, and he did not write about her in his autobiographies, did not really talk about her much, but as you paint the picture in Prophet of Freedom, she was an essential part of his success, his ability to be able to go out and travel the world and travel the country and publish a newspaper and do all the things he did. So how did you sort of unpack her story, because there wasn't a whole lot for you to work with?
It's one of the two or three biggest enigmas of Douglass's life as a biographer. His wife of 44 years, who followed him out of slavery with the equal bravery that he had, by the way. Even though she was free, she took all the same risks he did by then getting on the same set of trains and ferry boats he did about 4 days later once he got to New York. Anna remained, though, here's the enigma, Anna remained largely illiterate all of her life. For reasons we cannot entirely know, everyone speculates about it. You know, maybe she was dyslexic. Maybe she resisted his world. Maybe this and maybe that. They tried all kinds of efforts to get her tutors and to help her learn to read and to write, including her own daughter, who was actually quite well-educated, Rosetta, their oldest child. But it never worked, and Anna never became a reader, such that Douglass's, the most famous African-American of the 19th century, the most famous African-American writer of the 19th century, was married to a woman with whom he, by and large, did not share that intellectual pursuit, that intellectual world, and probably even large parts of his basic professional life. She was a thoroughly domestic woman. She raised five children. The fifth, Annie, her namesake, died at the age of 11 in a diphtheria outbreak. And she built his home every time, or, you know, helped create his home every time they moved, whether it was to New Bedford or to Lynn, Massachusetts, and then to Rochester, where they lived the longest, and then to Washington, D.C., and lived in two places in Washington, including the big house Cedar Hill. But Anna remained entirely, almost entirely homebound. Now, that's not that surprising in the 19th century, but she almost never traveled with Douglass. The way you can get at Anna, though, and it's still only the surfaces, is there are no less than three short narratives written about her by three of the children. Rosetta, the daughter, wrote a very public document called My Mother as I Recall Her, which is wonderful and quite revealing about the personality of her mother, who it turns out was a stern woman who ran her household and was a temperance woman, wanted no drinking in her house, and she was not fond of social events and all the people who kept dropping by the Douglass household. She did her best with all that, but it was not her favorite thing. Then there are two little narratives by two of the sons, and the only place they exist is in this Walter Evans collection in Savannah. They were among the many, many revelations of that collection. They're amazing as well. They're entitled Growing Up in the Douglass Household. And you can get at Anna by what other people say of her and about her, but you can also get at the difficulties of her life from that as well. It became a very difficult marriage over time. And when she died, after a whole series of strokes and bad health, she dies in the summer of 1882, the obituaries are a window, and there are many of them, are a window into all of the rigidity of gender roles in the 19th century, because the obituaries portray her as this perfect domestic, this perfect gardener, this perfect homemaker, this perfect mother for the great man. You know, you read the obituaries of Anna Douglass and you just feel for her. Didn't anybody bother to ask anybody who was she really? You know, no is the answer. The obituaries are more about him than they are about her. And that, again, is part of Douglass's story. Douglass dominated everything around him, every room he walked into, and he dominated in part by telling his own story over and over and over, and it is a great story to tell.
Well, you mentioned certainly the lack of empathy for how she felt, just in terms of even small things like the obituaries. Right. Obviously, times were very different then. But one of the things that I found really interesting about your biography is that while Douglas could be thoughtless and self-absorbed, particularly when it came to what was happening on the domestic front, he was also quite progressive when it came to women's rights and, you know, what was not known then as feminism, but would be considered so today. How did he come to have those views, do you think?
Well, yes, indeed. He was very much a public feminist and a public advocate of women's rights, not just of women's suffrage, but even women's economic rights. He was in every way, at least in the 19th century, a believer in women's equality. Now, how'd he come by that? Good question. Part of it was the strong women in his life. He'd never really knew his mother, but he'd heard she was literate. He'd heard she was beautiful. And he fashions images of his mother. He did know his grandmother, Betsy Bailey, who had more to do with raising him in his first 5 to 6 years than anybody else. And he, you know, greatly loved and admired her to the extent he knew her. But then there were other women. He was always in search of strong women friends, mother figures, women who could support him.
He needed Julia Griffiths. Badly. Would be an example.
Indeed, Julia Griffiths, the English woman he meets in England in 1846, and then who traveled to the U.S. in 1847-48, moved over to the U.S. in 1849. She was a highly educated, intrepid organizer of anti-slavery organizations in England. She clearly was enthralled, if not deeply in love with Douglas, but whether they were ever had a sexual affair or relationship, I think, is a very open question, and actually I doubt it in that case. But she came to the U.S., spent 6 years in Rochester, 6 years living in the Douglas household, well, the first 3 years in the Douglas house and the next three up the road a bit, after a scandal broke out caused by his former colleagues among the followers of William Lloyd Garrison in Boston, accusing him of having an affair right under the right under his own roof in front of his wife and children, which he totally denied, and so did Julia. But Julia was a very educated, strong woman who became his assistant editor on his newspaper, his primary fundraiser, and a deeply important confidant and friend. And they remained confidants and friends the rest of their long lives after she moved back to England. There are many, many, many letters they exchange way into old age, and they both lived almost to the same ripe old age in the 1890s. Now, so, you know, Douglas was not as self-made as he sometimes portrayed himself. One of his most famous speeches was, of course, entitled Self-Made Man. There were a lot of women along the way, and men, but a lot of women who helped make him, support him, including a whole network of women in Britain who raised money for him, raised money for his family, raised money for his newspaper, and kept his family afloat for a while in the 1850s. So his feminism, his belief in women's rights, has to be born to some extent of that. But he goes to the Seneca Falls Convention in 1848. He's just started his own newspaper in Rochester. He's only a year back from Great Britain. He's 28, 29 years old. He's the only male speaker at the Seneca Falls Convention. And he goes back to his newspaper in Rochester, which he just started 6 months earlier, and he puts a masthead on it that reads, "Right is of no color or sex." So he came out in his 20s, thoroughly in favor of the right to vote for women. Now, he will later have a terrible breakup, of course, with Susan Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Lucy Stone, and a few others over the 15th Amendment, which did not include women.
Right.
But that's a later chapter.
Again, our guest today is David Blight. He is the author of the new biography of Frederick Douglass called Prophet of Freedom. And I want to apologize to some listeners. I haven't even touched on William Lloyd Garrison. I haven't touched on President Lincoln much, John Brown. But I'm trying to ask you a little bit about some of the things in this biography that are different. And one of the things that struck me, very obvious, but Frederick Douglass was likely— half white. He didn't know his father, but he probably was a white man. And also, later in his life, he married a white woman, which, you can imagine, well, you don't even have to imagine, you know, became quite the scandal. So maybe you could address those two facets of his life.
Douglas was always fascinated. Well, first of all, he was always in search of trying to figure out just who his father was. His father was likely one of his two owners, but we still don't know. There's a possibility of DNA testing, but that hasn't yet been done yet. And by the way, I'm glad it wasn't done, because if Douglas didn't know, I didn't want to know before I ended the writing, finished the biography. I wanted to keep it historical. Anyway, so he always knows that he's probably the product of the sexual abuse, if not rape, of his own mother, in all likelihood. And the best candidate for his father is Aaron Anthony, his first owner, although we don't know for sure. Could have been Thomas Auld, his second owner. Don't know that for sure. So he always knows he's a part of both of these worlds. He's born a slave to a slave woman. But he may have been fathered by his own master. So he's property of the man who could be his father. He knows that. And he's also half white, half black, in a century that is obsessed with race. It's obsessed with the biology of race. Although Douglas had very modern views about the nature of race, he truly believed it is not a biological thing. It's a human construct, as we call it today. He understood that, and he wrote all about it in a famous speech in the 1850s on ethnology. Nevertheless, he has white kinfolk on the Eastern Shore. He just can never be quite sure who they are. It took a long time for him to even figure out who his black kinfolk were, much less the white kinfolk. And so, he's biracial in a country full of biracial people, hundreds of thousands of them. In fact, Douglas had some great funny lines about all of this. He used to say, you know, after the war, when people would complain and complain, it's one thing to have political equality, but what we don't want is social equality, by which they always meant interracial mixing. And Douglas used to say, well, where I grew up, we had too much social and not enough equality. And everybody got that, you know. Look at me, he'd say. And sometimes he would play on the joke that, yeah, I suppose you think my intelligence comes from my white side and my father, you know, and my brawn or something from my black side. He'd play with that and let people, you know, laugh a little bit about it if they needed to. And by the way, he never stopped looking for his paternity almost to the end of his life. He still had correspondence with one of Thomas Auld's sons, Benjamin Auld, who was potentially, you know, Auld family, potentially his relatives. In the last year of his life, he has correspondence with Benjamin Auld, who was potentially his half-brother, still asking, do you know anything more about my birthday? Do you know anything more about the circumstances of my birth? And he never got a yes from any of the Aulds, so I'm actually suspicious. I don't think it was Thomas Auld, but I don't know for sure. And he never knew.
Well, Professor Blight, I want to thank you for listeners. I would say pick up the book. There is so much more to this story. It really is an epic life. And do you know what you're going to do next?
I'm not sure yet, so I'm not gonna expose it. It might be another biography, but that's all I'll say.
Very good. Well, thank you again for the time. Again, the name of the book is Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom. It is by David Blight. Really a terrific read. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. You've been listening to Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.